Jesus. Yep. Should say something like abiding in Jesus. That looks great. There we go. Abide with me, O Lord, with me abide. Do 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 do. Help of the helper, Lord, abide with me. Do you feel like you can see that the TVs are a little bit bigger than they were? Yeah. I wondered if it was noticeable or... I'm just glad they work. Sounds good. And I'll try to make my way through the text in a way that you can figure out what you're following along on. Looks great by me. 15 minutes, we got this thing. Well, good morning, church. Merry Christmas to you. I am sorry to be with you in this context once again, but thanks for bearing with this way of us being under the Word of God together. I also want to extend my gratitude, personal gratitude, to Kevin Fitz for helping us as a church a couple weeks ago, where you may have noticed last week we were able to face the stage rather than having to face the back. And part of the reason, or a lot of the reason for that, was because Kevin gave up his time, created some wires for us so that these screens could work. And so I'm grateful once again that Kevin did that, because it's making it possible for you to enjoy this message now. So anybody who's close to Kevin, just give him a little pat on the back right there. The passage that was read for you, John chapter 15, is not necessarily what we would say connects to Advent, doesn't connect to the book of Acts that we were in, and it certainly doesn't connect directly to where we're going to be in the Psalms. However, with this, the last message of 2024, I want to be able to kind of envision us for the year ahead, but also to set us up for some themes that we're going to see as we're in the book of Psalms. In particular, next Sunday, we're going to be in Psalm chapter 1, Lord willing. And so the theme of John 15 kind of sets us up for what we're going to see there in the Psalms, and particularly what we're going to see next month, about the way that Jesus is the fulfillment and picture of a human who really is blessed by God, but also as the one who is the fulfillment of the Psalms, in that he's the one who satisfies every longing expressed in the Psalms. And so I'm looking forward to that time with you in January. But beyond that, I do hope that John chapter 15, as was read for us, sets us up well for what's ahead. What we're going to see in these 11 verses of John, though, is a pretty simple picture. It's a familiar one, but I do hope that it's one that we can freshly appreciate. From that, we're going to look at the goal and the command before we kind of take stock of our hope, both from this text and for this next year. So Let's take a look and we'll dive right into the first two verses here of John chapter 15 as we see this picture together. And the picture is pretty straightforward, isn't it? A picture that we might use in our day and age might not be the same one in a culture that is so spent and given to, just agriculture, vineyards and seeds and soils and all those kinds of things. And here, Jesus is using the metaphor of grapes and vines and fruit and vine dressing and branches and that kind of thing. And so we hear it right there in verse 1. I am the true vine. My Father is a vine dresser. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away. And every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes that it may bear more fruit. That's the picture that we see right here in John chapter 15, verses 1 and 2. And it starts with Jesus identifying himself in this metaphor and saying, I am the true vine. You see it right there in the beginning of verse 1. Jesus lets us know that as the vine, he's the first element of this metaphor that needs to be identified for us, which is helpful, particularly because it's so easy to read ourselves into so many of these different metaphors and ask questions that start with us. Jesus is letting us know that the thing he really wants us to start with, as he does in so many of John's other I am kind of sayings, is he wants us to start with who he is and what he provides. But the second character to enter into this metaphor is not just Jesus as the true vine, but it is his Father as the vine dresser. And that vine dresser there at the end of verse 1 is the one who has real responsibility to do things that may not be pleasant in any way. The vine dresser takes away and the vine dresser prunes. You see that in verse 2. It is the vine dresser who is the he that takes away, and it is the he that does the pruning. In other words, the work of the vine dresser is to cut back from what's going on this whole vine, and the cutting happens to the third element of this metaphor, which is the branch. Verse 2, we see it right there. Every branch in me that does not bear fruit, he takes away, and every branch that does bear fruit, he prunes so that it could bear more fruit. So what we have to grasp in the very beginning of this is the picture, the metaphor. A vine and a branch and a vine dresser. Jesus has identified who those are, and it is helpful us to recognize what he identifies and what he doesn't identify. Jesus doesn't identify anything about the soil, doesn't identify anything about seeds. Those are other parables not to be read into this one. Jesus also doesn't really make much mention in specific ways of the fruit, does he? He identifies fruit in the metaphor, but he doesn't specify the fruit in real life. In real life, though, we have Jesus, we have us, and we have the Father. Those are the characters that are made mention of and specified, and that's what's helpful for us. Now, we know this metaphor, but it might be helpful to just recognize that if Jesus were speaking in our day and age, to a digital age, he might speak more in terms of plugs and outlets and appliances. That might be a way of looking at it. Or cell phones and routers and modems and Wi-Fi connections. Those would be things that would make sense to us, right? If we were thinking about an appliance and an outlet and a plug, we might say something like, Jesus is the outlet, we are the appliance, and the Father is the one who's plugging and unplugging. It doesn't work quite as well, but you get the basic idea. He's tapping into something that they understand to get the idea of a source that's supposed to do so, or a source that's supposed to provide something, an object that's supposed to do something, and one who is evaluating the connection between the two of them. It's that connection that makes all the difference. And so that's the picture. Picture's right there. Verse 2 also, though, specifies not just this picture, but the goal in the picture. And so let's look at that point there in verse 2 as well. Every branch in me, he says, and he first says it negatively, that does not bear fruit. So if this second point is that the goal is to evaluate the branch, he evaluates this branch in two different ways, right? First, he says, there's a branch in me that does not bear fruit. And then he says, there is a branch that does bear fruit so that it may bear more fruit. You see those two parts that we've highlighted there. The beginning, every branch in me that does not bear fruit. And at the end, every branch that does bear more fruit. So what is it that is the goal that we're actually looking at here? The goal, quite clearly, is to bear fruit. That's why he says it repetitively here, negatively, does not bear fruit, and then positively, does bear fruit. But it's not just the question of whether or not something is happening. Fruit is being born or not being born. Look at the way that he says it positively at the end. Every branch, he says, that does bear more fruit, he's going to prune that branch. Why? So that it may bear more fruit. So in other words, the goal of being a branch that is connected to the vine, or the goal of being a disciple that is connected to Jesus, is not just whether we have in the past borne fruit or in the past never borne fruit. It is the question of whether or not we are bearing more fruit. And so the question isn't past fruit. It is a state of fruit bearing and a possibility of greater fruit being born into the future. Well, that's kind of helpful, isn't it? Because it's so easy for us at times to look backwards over our Christian life and ask the questions of whether we've done something or not done something. Have you ever gone on a missions trip? You've done it or you haven't done it. And if you've done it in the past, then you're good. You never really need to think about doing that again because it's already been a once and done thing. Have you ever given money away to some charitable cause? If you've done it or not done it, isn't it easy to kind of categorize ourselves that way, especially as we're thinking about things that would be fruit-bearing kinds of things in our lives? Something that clearly doesn't exist for the sake of the branch. That's an interesting point as well, isn't it? Fruit doesn't exist as the goal of a branch in order to beautify the branch. Fruit exists as the goal of the branch to provide something outside the life of the branch. The branch that bears fruit doesn't bear fruit for itself. It bears fruit for the one that would approach the branch and actually be granted and given benefits of the grapes that were on the branch themselves. See the point? So the way the metaphor is kind of working out, Christians don't exist in order to look fruitful so that they can get credit for being fruitful. Christians exist as followers of Jesus to be connected to Jesus so that the source of life from Jesus can be provided through that branch so that that branch does something that will benefit someone else outside of them. That's the goal of this metaphor, is that fruit would be born. Now, let's get into then the way that Jesus says this happens. And this is our third point. It's what we're going to call the command. The command begins right there in verse 4, and we read this: abide in me and I in you. As the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine, neither can you unless you abide in me. Do you hear the command? It's there. It's right there three times, in the beginning, in the middle, and at the end of verse 4. It is abide. Abide in me, he says, unless it abides in the vine, to use the metaphor. And then he comes back and addresses them again and says, you must then abide in me. So that's the command right there in the beginning. If you've ever read the old Dr. Seuss book called Marvin K. Mooney, Would You Please Go Now? There's a question that Marvin K. Mooney is being asked all throughout the book. It's whether he'll leave. And the book is ridiculous, because Marvin K. Mooney is being asked to go, and there's lots of stonewalling and lots of delays. And by the time the book kind of comes to an end, Marvin leaves. Why? Because somebody looks at Marvin and says, I said go, and go I meant. So the last line of the book is, the time had come, so Marvin went. Why? Because Marvin was commanded to do something. The book's ridiculous because in the beginning, Marvin is asked to leave. He doesn't leave. He doesn't go anywhere until he finally recognizes that none of these were suggestions. I said go, and go I meant. If we were to apply that same kind of logic, grammar logic, to this passage, we'd have to recognize right in the very beginning of verse 4, abide is not a suggestion. It is the absolute requirement for what it means for a disciple to bear fruit. Abide in me, verse 4, and I in you, as the branch cannot bear fruit by itself unless it abides in the vine. Get the metaphor? If you disconnect the branch from the vine, it's not going to bear any fruit, right? So then you can't bear fruit either. Neither can you unless you abide in me. I said abide, and abide I meant. The time had come, so Christians stalled and decided this was a suggestion and decided that fruit bearing was just supposed to make them look pretty so that they could be attractive vines or more impressive vines than others. That's not it at all. The goal is to bear fruit. The command is not bear fruit. The command is abide. And in fact, seven more times from verses 4 to 11 is this phrase used. It's there three times in verse 4, but then seven more times there's the same command to abide come up. And it's an odd word. We don't really use this word a whole lot, do we? We often think of abiding as sort of like dwelling. Maybe like stay in a house would be to abide. Another word that's often used is the word remain. But if we were to try and use it in this context and use it the way that we would talk about it, we'd just be saying, stay connected. If you have a branch and you wanted to tell the branch the one thing it had to do in order to be an effective branch in a vineyard, you would just say, well, just make sure that you're connected or you're growing or you're abiding or remaining. Make sure that you're part of the stalk and the stem. Just don't let that connection get broken. So stay plugged in, to use maybe our metaphor today of electricity and an appliance. But even that, if we were to try and work other words or translate the Greek word a little bit differently, those still would leave us maybe a little bit hollow. We read it here in verses 4 and following, but maybe we don't quite get exactly what it means to abide. And so Jesus gives a few different prepositions in order to help us in that process. In fact, we could specify this third command a little bit differently. It's not just to abide. The command is, first and foremost, he says, to abide in Jesus. Says it right there in verse 4. Abide in me. And he says it at the end, abide in me. And then he plays it out a little bit more. Verse 4, I am the vine, you are the branches. So whoever abides in me and I in him, whoever stays connected like this, he's the one that bears much fruit. For apart from me, you can do nothing. So if anyone does not abide in me, stay connected to me, keep their relational connectedness with me intact, he will be thrown away like a branch and withers. And the branches are gathered, thrown into the fire, and burned. Now again, in this metaphor, don't fall into the temptation of identifying things that Jesus doesn't quite identify. All that's been specified in this metaphor is the vine dresser, and the branches. What exactly does it mean to be burned is not the point, but it is a threat. And clearly it's bad. So the question that needs to be asked from this first part of this command is this: are we abiding in Jesus? And if that feels like the obvious point and you're not quite sure what that would even look like, how do I stay connected to Jesus? Jesus was a man who lived 2,000 years ago. Jesus was a man who, after dying for me and rising for me, rose from the earth in the ascension, and now is, in a way that I have trouble grasping, seated at the Father's right hand, in such a way that the Father's presence is real, invisible to me, but Jesus is human and ultimately still carrying this body that allows him to stand in as a human in the presence of God, which should never happen. How do I stay connected to him? I can't just go hang out with him. So Jesus gives us a couple other ways of staying connected to him. The second that he says isn't just abide in Jesus, it's abide in his words. So he spells that out as we get into verse 7. If you abide in me and my words abide in you, ask for whatever you wish and it will be done to you. You see it right there? The connection he makes is not just abiding in me, but that my words abide in you. And if you ask, well, what would that look like? You could say it would be about memorization, maybe. That would be a thing that kind of comes to mind, perhaps. If I were to memorize Jesus' words and somehow then his words were to be living deep within me, maybe that would be an indication that I'm doing what Jesus wanted me to do and my life is therefore going to be fruitful. But that might be the prerequisite, but that's not really the application Jesus gives, is it? He says, if you abide in me and if my words abide in you, then here's what you'll know. You can ask for whatever you wish, and it will be done for you. Now that is quite the promise. Can you imagine if Trinity Church in 2025 had the power to gather for prayer, and whatever we wanted would be done for us? If we could say that asking for whatever we want would happen, then you'd ask the question, wait, what is the if that would first then have to be fulfilled so that we could actually have this promise of getting whatever we want? Well, Jesus says it this way. My words need to be in you so much that my words, the vine of them, are creating so much life that life is flowing in you so that what's coming out from you is identical to what I would be asking for. You see a little bit more of what he's asking and what he's saying it would mean for his words to live in us? It's not just that we memorize Jesus' words like some magic prayer book, or like they become the coin that goes into the vending machine so we get whatever we want. They're not a spell. What they are is the means of changing our hearts so that the words that flow out from our hearts are the same words that Jesus would speak when he was here on the earth. See what it might mean for us to remain in Jesus? If remaining in Jesus and abiding in Jesus is the same thing of being so closely connected to what Jesus wanted and what he said, that those things live in us so that when we pray, we're not asking for our selfish desires. We're asking for those things that are in keeping with Jesus' will. Now, that may sound like an impossibility. But remember how this worked for Jesus when he was in the garden. In the garden, Jesus said, Father, I don't want this to happen, but if you want it to happen, then I want for it to happen. Would you take this cup away from me, but okay, not my will, but yours be done. Those were Jesus' words. Words where Jesus was wrestling with his Father in prayer in submission. Words where Jesus was borrowing from past psalmists in order to be able to express their confusion and their pain and their struggle and then fulfill that and say, these are now my words, and I'm saying that anyone who's praying like me using my words will have such a heart that the Father would do what they're wishing for. What a goal that would be. So to say it again, what if in 2025, Trinity Church was praying in such a way that our prayers are almost indistinguishable from what Jesus' prayers would be if he was sitting in our prayer group and praying among us? What if we prayed like that? Wouldn't you just expect those prayers to be answered? More than anything, wouldn't you expect that those prayers would be glorifying God? Because that's what he says right there in verse 8, right? This paragraph continues. He says, "By this my Father is glorified, that you bear much fruit and so prove to be my disciples." What would it look like to bear fruit? Well, it would look like praying like Jesus would pray. In fact, you could probably say it this way. I don't think that we're going to be a fruitful church in 2025 if we give up praying together. That doesn't make a lot of sense. For us to believe ourselves to be fruitful because we're doing this, we're doing that, and we're doing that when we've given up talking to God in the first place. So my hope for us is that we'll be gathering together in contexts that are official Trinity Church kind of contexts, but also in smaller contexts and in times where we're just hanging out together. Let's let our prayers together be part of the way that we glorify God when we're together. This is what Jesus said in John chapter 14. "Whatever you ask in my name, this I will do, so that the Father may be glorified in the Son. And if you ask me anything in my name, I will do it." You see how indistinguishable praying and abiding in Jesus' words are from praying and abiding in Jesus himself. But the last way we could say that we're abiding in Jesus is not just that we're abiding in his words, but we're abiding in his love. Jason, I'm going to skip a couple of the slides here and just move us straight into this last point. Because this is where Jesus takes us. To abide truly in Jesus is to be so aware of his life and his words that the only thing that really radiates out to us is that we are so deeply loved by him. He says this in verse 9, and he links the word abide straight to it. "As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. So abide in my love. If you keep my commandments, you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and I abide in his love." Now, don't let the word commandments throw you off. It almost might seem like all of this was meant to be relational. All of this is affirming. All of this is just reminding us that we are connecting ourselves to Jesus. We're reminding ourselves of what Jesus has said and how Jesus has loved us. And then the word commandments just gets thrown out there like a belch in the middle of an opera or something like that. It's not that way. Jesus is basically saying in verse 10, if you want to know how to follow me and to do what I'd like, if you want to obey me, remember how much I love you. It's going to be indistinguishable then from the way that you are following me because you are thinking about how I love you. You're thinking about what I've promised to you. And so if you're keeping my commandments, you're abiding in my love just this way. How is it that I always did my Father's will? I remembered that he loved me. And so you're going to do this just as I have abided in my Father's love. And so I have kept his commandments. It's hard to know how to read this as the cart and the horse, right? It's easy for us to always revert back to thinking that God only loves us because we obey him. And we might think that that's the way this is written, because the if is, if you keep my commandments, then you will abide in my love, just as I have kept my Father's commandments and abided in his love. And there's a sense that that could kind of make some logical, you know, a logical point. We would say that it's difficult for us to say that we love someone whose will we just completely disregard. It would make no sense for a husband to ask a wife, a boyfriend to ask a girlfriend, where do you want to go out to eat? What's your favorite food? And they say, oh, I just love Mexican. They would think, thanks, Olive Garden it is. That's where we're going. That wouldn't make sense, would it? It wouldn't make sense to hear what somebody else wanted, tell them you love them, and then as an expression of your love, do something entirely different. It doesn't mean that everything plays out exactly according to that analogy. But generally speaking, Christmas time, parents were glad to ask their kids, well, what do you want? And then as best they could and could afford, to be able to satisfy those desires and be able to give gifts that are in keeping with what the kids want as an expression of love. Jesus is just making that same point. If we're truly going to abide in Jesus, then we're going to be abiding in his love. Verse 9 plays that out right here. As the Father has loved me, so have I loved you. What a great starting point for how we think about abiding in his love. As the Father loves me, so I have loved you. So he says, abide in my love. And then he says it again in verse 10, abide in my love. And the way that Jesus showed us his love was that exact moment in Mark 14. When he said, Abba, Father, all things are possible for you. Remove this cup from me, yet not what I will, but what you will. What was that? That was a moment of Jesus expressing his love to the Father and saying, what you would have for me at this moment, I would also have. But it's more than that, isn't it? It's not just Jesus expressing his love to the Father to obey his will. It's Jesus turning to us and expressing his love for us because of the way that we benefit from his obedience at that point. And our love looks exactly the same, doesn't it? We connected to Jesus and connected to his words to us and his great love for us. We are the ones who then in turn, out of that connection, bear fruit, but not for us. That's why Paul is so clear when Paul is able to say, I want you to bear fruit in keeping with the Spirit's work in you, because what the Spirit is going to do in you is he's going to remind you of the love of Jesus. And the more you are abiding in the love of Jesus, the more you are connected to Jesus, the more you are, to use Paul's kind of language, reminded of the love of Jesus and being sort of overwhelmed with these concepts of the love of Jesus, then what you're going to be doing in your life is you're going to be bearing fruit. And you're going to love. And that love won't be for you, it'll be for somebody else. And you're going to have joy and peace. And think of this one, patience. When have you ever been patient in a way that was primarily for your benefit? That's not the way patience works, is it? Patience, yes, benefits us, reduces our stress levels and all those kinds of things. But patience, rightly understood, is to be able to extend mercy. It's to be able to give time. It's to be able to treat somebody else the way that our long-suffering God has been treating us. He's been waiting for us to change. He's been patient towards us. He's been suffering a long time with us. And so because that's the way we know we've been loved, we get to do the exact same thing to other people. And so the fruit of the Spirit is always something produced out of our connection to Jesus, but something that's always benefiting others. Something that's always really for the ultimate good of what the vine dresser is doing in all these connected tangles of vines that make up his vineyard. His vineyard is all of us entangled up ways connected to Jesus, bearing fruit that he comes through and tends, and that he comes through and prunes. Wisely saying, you don't need this, you don't need this, you don't need this, because I recognize they're distracting your energy. We're going to get rid of them so that you're not thinking that's where you need to put yourself into. Instead, I'd rather have all that energy from Jesus flow through you into this scenario here. And that's the way the vine dresser works. Where he sees a little fruit, he's eager to get more fruit. And so he's going to cut away things from our lives. And those moments are difficult. But this is where we remember, that's the way we were loved by Jesus. So that we, loved by Jesus, when he said, not my will, but yours, we can love others like Jesus when we're connected to him and we say the same way, not my will, but your will. Take this away, remove this, and have me pour all my energy here so that I can be patient in this moment, so that I can be self-controlled in this way. And you produce fruit as you would. Because it's easy at those moments, isn't it? To think that what the vine dresser is doing is taking away the things that would truly make us happy. That's really the lie of the serpent that still makes its way through the vineyard now and then. Coming up and sliding up next to the branch and saying, you needed that. That leaf was gonna be good. Oh, why did he take that away? The vine dresser must not care about you or about others. And yet Jesus ends with where our hope truly exists in this entire process. And it's in us enjoying Jesus. That at the end of the day is our hope. And that's why our passage here ends with this promise. These things, Jesus says, I have spoken to you so that my joy may be in you and so that your joy may be full. Now, in your bulletin, you see that we have kind of set this out for you to think your way through these 11 verses. We talked about a picture, talked about a goal, we talked about a command, and we've talked about our hope. But as we think ahead to the next year, I want to think with you through four yes or no questions that I think may help us a little bit to identify what would this look like in our church over this next year. So the first diagnostic question might be a little bit more just like this. Does this picture of Jesus as our source of life reflect the reality of your life's structure? You see what I'm saying? What I'm asking is if the things that are most important for us are us as a branch, Jesus as a vine, and our Father is the vine dresser, does that reflect the structure of the way that we have set up our lives? Because life is full of a bunch of dead stalks out there. Things that mimic the vine so that we as a branch might knit ourselves into them, remain in them, stay connected to them above everything else. And yet there's no life in them. And so this picture itself makes us ask questions of the structures of our lives and evaluate the goals that we have for this next year and ask, does this picture really reflect the way that my life is set up? Is Jesus anywhere to be found in all the structures of my week, the structures of my life and my relational network? Does Jesus and our connectedness to him show up anywhere in the way that I spend my time? That's what I mean by the structures of our lives. The second question comes down to this goal. And again, the second yes-no question is this. Does the goal of bearing fruit motivate how you evaluate your life's commitments? Because we do this all the time, don't we? Start a business? Is it making money? Well, maybe not. All right, we probably ought to give it up. Take up a hobby. Is this making you feel a little bit less stressed? Are you having fun? Is it producing something good? Is it sort of being a diversion for you that you're enjoying? If not, I would probably give it up. But if the goal that's been put forward for us here in John 15 is that we're to be bearing fruit, not just stuff that beautifies us, but stuff that benefits others, then is that the way that we evaluate what we're committed to and not committed to? It's hard to listen to this text and walk away and say, nah, I don't need God's goals to really evaluate or shape my commitments into this world. I don't think that's the best way for us to live, is it? Third question is this. Does the command of abiding in Jesus affect what you set up as your life's retreats? By retreats, I mean the places and things you go to in order to disconnect and help your mind settle. This is one probably for me that if I had to go yes, no on any of them, I'd probably more frequently than not have to answer no to number three. Because there are a bunch of other things that just feel like where I want to let my mind go to in order to be able to find some sort of retreat from the stresses of life. This is why life and all its allurements can be so very addicting, can't it? Why media can be so overwhelming. It's why social media in particular can be so alluring. It's why movies, it's why all the different things that we can give ourselves to can feel like retreats from what God really has for us, when I think that the command of actually remaining in Jesus and being connected to Jesus ought to be more powerful for us than what we think about doing in order to disconnect from all the stresses of life. Fourth question is this: does the hope of having a life that you could call enjoyable empower your next steps? I'll promise you this one. I think all of you are answering yes to that. The hope that we're going to do something that's going to make 2025 an enjoyable year, that's going to motivate all of us. But what I think ought to really motivate us coming out of John 15, 1 to 11, is the way that Jesus says what should be most enjoyable for us. Jesus says, I've told you all of this, right there in verse 11, so that my joy could be in you and that your joy could be full. So that you could have what you could think of as a joy-filled life. It's so easy for us to envision other things making us happy. But the reminder coming out of this is that Jesus isn't lying in the first 11 or the first 10 verses before this. He's not lying whenever he says, you being connected to me and bearing fruit from me and even being pruned by my Father so that that could be more real and more potent and more alluring for all that would be able to come and benefit from that fruit. That process is going to be the thing that will fill you up and make your life enjoyable. So with those four questions kind of asked of us, here's the last one that I think we should be talking about. Maybe as we go from here into New Year's Eve, maybe as we just think about how we're going to be building this next year, maybe it's something to chew on a little bit and to bring up in conversation with others. But what might be one shift that we could make as a church family that might move us closer to this hopeful picture in John 15? Is there anything that we're doing that maybe we just don't want to keep doing? Or maybe it's not so much structural stuff, but maybe there are individual questions and we have to each ask, what is it that I'm bringing to the table in our church that is helping me to live along the lines of where John 15 is at? Or what is it that I'm doing in my life that's sort of moving our church collectively away from this goal? What have I been doing to invite others into this life of being connected to Jesus? Because ultimately, as we wrap up the next year, and as we start making plans for 2026 and beyond, I don't think anything that we've read in these 11 verses is going to be more significant, because what we're hopeful about and what we're eager for is that Jesus would get much fruit from the vineyard of our church. So let's pray. And let's ask God to help that happen among us over this next year. Father, we are grateful for the way that you are at work. And yet, if we admit, sometimes we're really not too grateful about the stuff that you do that spurs on our growth and spurs on our fruit bearing. We're not grateful for the things that you do that make us more patient or self-controlled. We're not grateful for the ways that you are at work in our lives, where things that we thought we should be excited about are things that you take away from us. But Father, I'm grateful that as all of us are thinking back over our lives, and we recognize things that you've taken away from us, we've recognized that in the midst of those are moments that we've either seized or ignored, where we could reconnect to you. We could remember your words and remember your love. And we could have hope that through losses, you're actually deepening our connection to Jesus, and therefore making us pray more like him and live more like him. Because at the end of the day, Lord, what we hope for any who come through our doors, for any who meet us both in this building and outside of this building, our hope is that when they encounter us, they would encounter Jesus. So we lay our year before you, Lord, this one that we're wrapping up and this one that we're looking into. And we ask, Father, would you do what you need to do in our lives so that the life of Jesus would bear fruit in this church? We pray this in his name. Amen. Stand together and let's sing. Well, you know, I mean, in one sense it would, in the other, it would really ruin your day.